Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And here we go. Iowa, the economy, the healthcare debate, and Twitter on the broadcast today. Yes, what's old is news again, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, January 3rd, and it's all over in Iowa, but the counting, that is. The caucuses are tonight, the first actual votes in a campaign that already feels long. Despite the various ups and downs, though, the Republican candidates are getting something of a bargain this year because this has been, so far, the cheapest primary season in more than a decade. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ganser reports.
I love a bargain and free stuff. If I were campaigning for president this year, I'd be in seventh heaven. I'd be getting lots of TV exposure at no cost. There have been more debates than usual.
I'll tell you what the facts are.
Rick, again.
All the debate dust-ups have actually made them interesting TV. The candidates drew big audiences.
And that was absolutely free. All they have to do is show up.
That's Republican strategist Alex Vogel. He says there's more free TV on cable news shows, and then there's the overall mood of the voters.
And most of the focus of normal, average Americans has been on the economy. Look, if you're a campaign, why waste money when people aren't paying attention?
Vogel says voters are just starting to pay attention, so we'll be hearing more campaign ads like this one bashing Newt Gingrich.
Newt has more baggage than the airlines.
That sounds like the type of ad one of Gingrich's rivals would pay for. So are the candidates finally opening their wallets? Nope.
Restore Our Future is responsible for the content of this message.
Restore Our Future is a super PAC, which supports Mitt Romney. It paid for the ad. Super PACs are new independent groups that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. They're not supposed to coordinate with the campaigns. Sheila Krumholz heads the Center for Responsive Politics. She says the candidates can just stand back and let the super PACs run expensive ads on their behalf.
We'll have these outside groups promoting specific candidates, and that really becomes an extension of the candidate's campaign.
Political strategist Jordan Lieberman says that way candidates can save their money until later in the campaign. Candidate spending is lower now than it was 4 years ago, but Lieberman says the campaign is just heating up, and he still expects spending for this election to break the 2008 record.
So, will we spend more than $1.7 billion in the 2012 campaign cycle? I promise you, yes.
Lieberman says campaign spending has gone up every year since 1984. If candidates have money in the bank, they will eventually spend it on TV ads, staff, consultants, chartered jets, and fancy hotels. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Ganser for Marketplace.
Nancy talked about negative ads in that piece. Here's a dollar figure to give you some context. According to the research group Kantar Media, almost $6 million were spent on political TV ads in Iowa last year. Almost $4 million of it for negative spots. Nothing negative at all on Wall Street today. A tiny little start to 2012. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Strange sounds the good residents of Youngstown, Ohio, heard Christmas Eve turned out not to have been Santa on the roof at all. They were earthquakes. Same thing happened New Year's Eve as well in places close to a controversial type of natural gas drilling that's come to be known as fracking. Earthquakes are yet another hazard associated with fracking that's led to yet louder calls for bans, which the state of Ohio partially did today. As part of his duties at the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has been out and about at some fracking sites, and he's got our report today.
Ohio shut down five wells where wastewater from natural gas drilling was being injected underground. Did the pressure cause the quakes? Seismologist Leonardo Sieber at Columbia University.
When you find an earthquake that's at that distance in time and space with injection of fluid underground, it's clear that it is a relationship. It's not by chance.
Ohio's Oil and Gas Association calls it a rare and isolated event. Maybe, but tell it to the activists trying to ban fracking. Now they have another cloud to paint over the sector. There's quakes and maybe dirty drinking water and maybe gas in my kitchen faucet. Amy Mall is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
We do support keeping the most sensitive places, whether it's the most sensitive for human health, for wildlife, for drinking water sources. We do think those areas need to be kept off limits.
Right now, New York bans fracking, as does France. Could that happen nationwide here? Most independent observers agree with Rob Jackson. He teaches environmental science at Duke.
I don't think in the United States that's likely at all. I don't think the political situation is the same. France also has completely different landowner rights, so that people there don't own the mineral rights the same way that people here do.
Investors seem to agree. Just yesterday, French producer Total injected $2 billion into U.S. gas development, as did a Chinese firm. And all that got the attention of Jack Plunkett. He does energy market research in Houston.
You know, the purchases we're seeing are immense. They're in the multi-billion dollar range many times, and they're being paid for with cash. So that implies a really big buyer when that happens.
Big Oil sees global demand for gas, that it's abundant and cheap, and only half as carbon sinful as coal. By one estimate, global use of gas will leap 50% by 2035. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
From the pages of the Los Angeles Times today comes this story. Bank of America is tightening up on credit for some of its small business borrowers. B of A insists the number of companies actually affected is small, but the news is a good window into a problem facing a lot of small business owners: how to get the cash they need as banks get pickier about who they lend to and how much they lend at all. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
B of A is one of the country's top lenders, with more than a million small business clients. Spokesman Jefferson George insists the bank isn't cutting back on credit across the board. In fact, its new business loans are up 30%. What B of A is doing, he says, is changing the terms for some older loans.
What we've done is put in some standard practices for a very, very, very small percentage of our customers, such as a maturity date and an annual renewal process.
That means some small business owners may have to pay their loans off right away, face higher interest rates, or lose their lines of credit. S&P banking analyst Eric Oja says this makes sense for B of A.
Bank of America is under severe pressure from its regulators to raise capital now and to reduce risk. And they will cut down lines of credit that have any risk.
But it's not just B of A doing this, says Bob Coleman. He publishes a report on small business lending. He says all banks are under pressure to improve the quality of their loans.
Where the borrower may be up to the maximum, the regulators are actually going to go into that bank and force them to write off a portion of the loan.
Cookie Driscoll has a one-woman business in Pennsylvania selling promotional gifts and equestrian products. She lost her line of credit with PNC Bank last year and had to pay the remaining balance of $6,000 in one lump sum.
So I ended up borrowing from a family member to be able to pay that off.
So bank of family, better interest rate?
No. I try to run this like a business.
So far, Driscoll hasn't looked for a new line of credit. She says she's skittish of banks right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a case in California Small Claims Court today which hinges in part on this question. What's the definition of 50 miles per gallon? You'd think it's 50 miles driven for every gallon of gas, right? The plaintiff's hybrid Honda Civic only got 30, she says, so she's suing. But really, does anybody actually ever get the gas mileage that's advertised? Marketplace's Adrienne Hill looked into it.
The short answer is yes. Perfect people living in a perfect world.
People will get the advertised mileage only under very perfect conditions.
Okay, very perfect people living in a very perfect world. Phil Reed is with auto website Edmunds.com. He says it's important to know that MPG is a range. City driving at the low end, highway driving at the high end, and most of us winding up right in the middle. Researcher John DeChico at the University of Michigan says sticker MPG is best thought of in relation. Say you're choosing between two cars. One advertised MPG of 30, another with 33.
The odds are very, very good that you're going to get better mileage in a 33-mile-per-gallon vehicle. That doesn't mean you're going to get 33, though.
Now, there's added confusion here. Those new federal standards you've heard about, 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025, those are based on a different set of MPG estimates, even less connected with reality. DeChico estimates that when they're in place, it'll mean we'll be driving around in cars that get mileage in the high 30s. Back at Edmunds, Reed tells me drivers who want to increase their fuel efficiency should be more, you guessed it, perfect. No quick acceleration, no slamming on the brakes. At least that's the idea.
Sometimes they continue to drive aggressively, but, you know, when gas prices go high, they know where to go, you know, for real savings.
So if gas prices get really high, we'll just have highways full of very docile drivers.
Wouldn't that be nice?
A person can dream. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Today was the third and final round of parliamentary elections in Egypt. Things are still kind of up in the air there, almost a year after the protests that toppled Hosni Mubarak. And a lot of Egyptians are complaining the economy is no better since the military took over from Mubarak. It's a military that, by the way, has a sizable stake in that very economy. From Cairo, Julia Simon reports.
At a gas station in Cairo, Mustafa Hassan is buying a packet of cigarettes and a bottle of water. He opens up a large, well-lit refrigerator.
And I'm buying a kind of mineral water. It's called Safi, but it's made for the army forces to help them.
So most of the stuff here was made by the army? Do you mean that?
Yeah, maybe some of them, they really make some things here, like they make this water, they made this pickles, maybe this macaroni, this oil.
Oh, they make the olive oil?
Yeah.
There is something strange about Egypt, in that the military economy is so relatively large. It did not used to be this way.
Robert Springboard's a professor at the Naval Institute in Monterey, California. He says the Army first moved into large-scale economic activities in 1979. Egypt had just signed a peace treaty with Israel. The top brass feared the peace dividend would lead to downsizing, so the Army got involved in everything from consumer goods to construction to tourism. Springboard estimates that military companies and those owned by retired officers now make up about a quarter of the Egyptian economy. He says they stifle competition from private sector firms of all sizes.
You don't have to be small to be at the mercy of the military and the officer economy. You can be very large indeed, but if you're in areas that they want to control themselves, you're in trouble.
Some disagree, like retired General Mohammed Kadri, the head of military studies at the government-affiliated Ahram Center in Cairo. He insists the army controls only 2 or 3% of Egypt's economy, and besides, it's easy to find out about it.
The military is not working underground. If you have a factory, the factory is there. I mean, if you have a shop, the shop is there. That's why when people like you come here and say to me that the military are representing 30% of the Egyptian economy. So I said, okay, so come to count them.
But that's not as easy as it sounds. When I went to Helwan, an industrial area south of Cairo, I went to a street to count military factories, and I got detained for 12 hours. The Egyptian military doesn't welcome scrutiny by outsiders, nor by Egyptians either. Again, Robert Springborg.
The military does not pay taxes, and indeed its internal accounts are subject to no oversight or control by the parliament, by the general accounting organization, or indeed by anyone else.
In recent years, an expert unit in the Ministry of Finance was trying to get more access to military companies and get them paying taxes. The military continues to resist this. Right now, Egyptians are voting for a new parliament. If it should get serious about overseeing the military economy, Springborg says the finance ministry would be up for the job. But Professor Zainab Abulmegd, an Egyptian who teaches history at Oberlin College in Ohio, says oversight is not enough. She says it's time for the army to get out of business altogether.
I call for withdrawal of the military from the economy because this is holding Egyptian national economy back. We have a military junta that is controlling the economy in a Soviet manner. They are damaging the Egyptian economy at every level.
But in post-Mubarak Egypt, the army remains a very powerful player, and it's too early to say if it's ready to get out of the economy and focus on the business of, well, just being an army. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The whole idea of Twitter is that celebrities have direct access to their fans.
The curious case of the unverified account. But first, let's do the numbers. On the first trading day of 2012, the Dow Industrial surged 179 points, 1.4%, closed at 12,397. The NASDAQ up 43 points, 1.2%, finished at 2,648. The S&P 500 added 19 points, about 1.5%, ended things at 1,277. Investors were cheered by better-than-expected economic data here in the U.S., but also in China and Germany. All but four blue chips gained. McDonald's, the Dow's best performer last year, was today's biggest loser, sadly. Shed about 1.5%. To complete the irony, Bank of America was the index's worst stock last year, but today led the way up with a gain of 4.3%. Go figure that out. Financial stocks in general performed well today. Citigroup deposited 7.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for November. Did anyone find a new car under the tree this Christmas? Come on, Santa. Automakers are scheduled to release sales figures for December. And on January 4th, 2007, Nancy Pelosi was elected Speaker of the House. She was the first woman to hold the position. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This being just day three of 2012, you're going to be pretty safe should you venture a guess as to what's going to merit news coverage this year, seeing as how nothing's actually happened yet. So we are going to pick up today with our commentary series, What Now? Thoughts about what is going to be in the headlines the next 12 months. And here's a hint for today's entry. Individual mandate, the new requirement that everybody have health insurance. Commentator Dahlia Lithwick explains.
For 3 days this March, the Supreme Court will hear argument in a case that will be the constitutional equivalent of the Super Bowl, the Oscars, and the presidential election all rolled into one. They've set aside 5.5 hours to hear challenges to President Obama's health care law. The case promises lots of heavy betting, mild bruising, secrecy, tears, and a rare foray into election year politics. The justices generally try to stay away from this sort of clear and present drama, especially after Bush v. Gore, but timing made it impossible to dodge this one. Over the course of 3 days, the justices will evaluate four separate questions. Is the individual mandate an unconstitutional encroachment on individual liberty? If the individual mandate falls, does the entire law collapse? Did Congress violate states' rights by expanding the Medicaid program? And can a 19th century tax law make this whole dispute go away for a few years? Appeals of these and other issues have meandered up through the federal courts, and appeal courts have split across ideological lines. The court may find a way to put off a final decision for a year. They could strike down the individual mandate but uphold the law, uphold the whole thing, or gut it all. Any route they choose will shape the presidential election, and any decision they make will put the court itself at the heart of the raging debate we are having about how America should govern itself. Don't be so quick to believe the wiseacres who tell you the healthcare case is guaranteed to come down 5-4 conservative liberal in the manner of a Bush v. Gore 2.0. Some of the court's conservatives have embraced an expansive view of congressional power. Tea Party concerns about freedom are not of paramount importance at this court, and decades of precedent are hard to ignore. Two promises are all I can offer. Nobody will be recusing themselves, and you won't see one moment of it on TV.
Dahlia Lithwick is the senior legal correspondent at Slate. You can send us your thoughts about the year to come. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. At this point in the year, that is to say right at the very start, maybe what you're hoping to hear from us is some optimism about the economic road ahead. And there are promising signs out there, don't get me wrong. But 3+ years of being stuck in an economic rut gives us this. A study that figured out how many of us are going to fall off a financial cliff in the year ahead. Marketplace's David Brancaccio is here with this bracing bit of reality. Hey, David, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
I fear, though, Mr. Brancaccio, that you will start the new year off with bad news for me. Right?
I know. Look what I picked here. No one wants to think about the chances of hitting the skids financially, but maybe what? Forewarned is forearmed. I want to look at what's called the Economic Security Index. How many of us will see a major economic loss in 2012? If you look at the statistics, more than 20% is the answer. Trend is if, what, five of you are in a carpool listening right now, one of you will see a huge drop in income at a time when you don't have the cash or the savings to deal with that.
But for that guy who's the unfortunate soul sitting in the back of the middle seat there in that carpool, what does that mean?
Well, this is how they figured it out. What it means is, what are the chances your income is going to fall 25% or more this year? This is also when you factor in out-of-pocket medical expenses. They found that many of the people who went off this kind of financial cliff were unable to meet at least one basic need, like maybe the rent, or you can't even go to the doctor if you need it. Now, obviously, this affects poor people, but the researchers note the dangers also lurk for households with incomes between $60,000 and $100,000 a year.
But isn't this, David, the way the, maybe not the business cycle, but the economic cycle works? I mean, you're up and you're down.
Exactly. So the researchers looked at this. They factored in the ebbs and flows of the economy. But economic security over the last quarter century keeps trending the wrong way. In fact, here's the guy behind this index, Yale University political scientist Jacob Hacker.
Just getting the economy moving again isn't going to restore economic security as we once understood it, because this is a long-term decline, and it's rooted not just in the instability of employment, but also in the weakening financial safety nets of Americans and the runaway nature of American healthcare costs.
And yet, though, David, if you look at a lot of the polling that's out there, people still think the United States is a land of opportunity.
Exactly. We're advertised as a land of opportunity. Right. But I got bad news for you there, too, my friend.
Of course you do.
Yeah, the Pew Research Center's got a whole program on what they call economic mobility in America. What are the chances that, for instance, our kids will do better than us? Pew's latest research shows that when it comes to mobility, we're doing worse than any country they looked at. Canada, France, Italy. But here's the thing. How well your kids do in the U.S. is closely connected to how much education, wait for it, the parents got, not necessarily how much the kids are getting. So we're locked into some sort of education and income levels of our backgrounds.
Yeah, so for my kids, it's already too late, right? I should have gotten that PhD or something, and everybody else should have kept going to college and all that stuff.
Yeah, you and me both. And don't tell this to anyone waiting for their college acceptance letters in the coming weeks, right? But there's an interesting exception, the very little ones. In an effort to find something positive to bring to the table here, I have three words: early childhood education. I spoke with Nancy Newman. She runs a preschool for children from homeless families in Baltimore.
Everybody needs that foundation because it's a foundation for life. That's where you learn language skills, social skills, two fundamental things you learn in preschool that carry through for the rest of your life.
Preschool, one of the very few ways up the economic ladder in that Pew study that I talked about. Yeah. The research found that a couple more years preschool translates to a couple percentage points in income later in life.
Assuming, of course, there are the jobs to be had. David Brancaccio, our Economy 4.0 correspondent. David, thank you.
You bet.
You can, should you so choose, follow me on Twitter. At Kai Rizdahl is the handle. You're going to have to take my word for it that it's really me doing the tweeting. But for actual celebrities and higher profile people, Twitter will verify that the tweeter in question is actually who he or she says she is. Sort of. Rupert Murdoch's wife started a Twitter account this weekend. Yes, that Rupert Murdoch. He of News Corp and British phone hacking scandal fame. Except the account at Wendy Dung wasn't really Mrs. Murdoch at all. Sally Herships has the story.
The latest symbol of celebrity status is having someone fake or hack your Twitter account.
Crystal Palin, Selena Gomez, Marc Jacobs.
That's David Hauslieb, editor of celebrity news site Pink is the New Blog. He says, for A-listers, getting Twitter faked happens all the time. A couple of years ago, Twitter itself got hacked.
That led to Britney Spears' official account tweeting about her private parts.
One troublemaker at a keyboard can stir up a lot of mess with social media. Sharon Waxman is editor of TheWrap.com.
I mean, there's like a million Lady Gaga doppelganger accounts or whatever you want to call them.
Sometimes it's hard to tell which is real. To prevent bogus accounts, Twitter says it first started verifying authors back in 2009. But the process isn't perfect. Twitter said today it had mistakenly verified the account of Rupert Murdoch's wife. And for Gaga-level celebrities, this can be a monster-sized problem. Sharon Waxman again.
Because the whole idea of Twitter is that celebrities have direct access to their fans.
Which fans love, direct access, not through a movie studio or a record company. Celebrities love it, too. Joel Piper is a pop singer. He's just wrapping up a tour, so he called me from the road.
I actually have, conversations with a lot of fans, and they don't have my phone number.
Piper calls his 17,000 Twitter followers his friends, except for the ones who create fake accounts. But despite the hassles, Piper says it's worth it. And so likely does Rupert Murdoch. His verified Twitter account, which he opened this weekend, already has over 95,000 followers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with a disclaimer that I am the last guy in the world who wants to read the minutes of Federal Reserve meetings. But the official notes of the December session that came out today did have an interesting tidbit inside. From now on, the central bank is going to start telling us four times a year exactly how long it's going to keep interest rates where they are. That's instead of the usual for the foreseeable future thing that they often do. It's all part of the Fed's new communication strategy under Chairman Ben Bernanke. They are trying to be more open. Best part about this whole gig? The decision was actually made a month ago. They kept it secret till today. I could tell you the name of the broadcast, but then I'd have to kill you now. I hate it when people say that. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow surged 179 points, about 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 43 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 put on 19 points. That's 1.5% to start 2012. Thanks to Justin Ho, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Next time, back here.
We then had 2.4 million people in crisis. The prices had doubled, and the outlook was not good.
The economics and the politics of American foreign aid. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.